If you've been told to pull up your socks, then make sure it's a pair of TNT socks. The TNT shop is now open at TNTRadio.live. From economics to the woke agenda, this is Unleashed with Mark Morano on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome back to Unleashed with Mark Morano on TNT. All right. Breaking news. The National Institutes of Health has now officially admitted to funding gain-of-function research in Wuhan through the EcoHealth Alliance. I have a clip of this at the congressional hearing, the select subcommittee on the coronavirus pandemic. And they've also been, I guess, blacklisted. They've been, blacklisted, banned from government contracts, from doing this work. So everything in our last conversation with Corinne Clifford, we just talked about everything that anyone reported on about the source of the virus was all misinformation, disinformation. You were censored, shut down. You were banned from social media, Facebook and YouTube and Twitter at the time, pre-Elon Musk. Government's now admitting it's all true. Sorry, it's true. Of course, we knew this at the show. I've tracked this. We've had many guests on. I've showed you the clips of Jeffrey Sachs, the NYU professor, who joined happily with his public health colleagues. He was a public health insider with Peter. Is it Peter Daszak or was it the other guy? I think it was Peter Daszak. And it was also Fauci that he worked with and realized that people weren't telling the truth. He now says Fauci was an outright liar. And this is a guy who was at every UN summit. He's with them on public health, on climate. He's being red-pilled, though, as we speak. I may have some more clips of him. He's someone to watch. NYU professor Jeffrey Sachs, not NYU, a Columbia University professor, I believe. But he is not. There's another guy named Jeffrey Sachs. This is a different Jeffrey Sachs. Anyway, this is clip one, NIH admitting now gain-of-function research and of the EcoHealth Alliance, and now that's been banned. Clip one.
Dr. Tabak, did NIH fund gain-of-function research at the Wuhan Institute of Virology through EcoHealth?
It depends on your definition of gain-of-function research. If you're speaking about the generic term, yes, we did, but this is research. The generic term is research that goes on in many, many labs around the country. It is not regulated. And the reason it's not regulated is it poses no threat or harm to anybody.
He's admitting they funded it. It's not regulated. So I don't really quite know what they did. And of course, these groups are now, at least the government is getting tons of pressure. The Republicans in Congress, they can't really do anything because, I mean, they're limited in what they can do because they don't have the Senate, but they are having some great hearings. They are exposing this. Even some in the Senate, when they have the hearings, you'll see Rand Paul, but he's getting less and less opportunities because the Democrats control the Senate at this point. This is very important stuff. A lot of people think, oh, COVID's old or who cares? Unless people are held accountable, unless we can expose this, it will happen again and again and again. It still may happen again, but our biggest thing is mass resistance. We can never go along with this again. All right. Clip two, I love. This is Marjorie Taylor Greene, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, congresswoman from the Bronx, and Democrat Jasmine Crockett at a House Oversight Committee hearing. This is three women behaving badly, she would say. And I'm not really going to defend Marjorie Taylor Greene here. It's silly. The whole thing is silly. But I think you should watch it because this is what's going on in Congress. This is clip two. I'll just let you watch it and you can have some fun. It's a free-for-all of insults, shouting, yelling, bickering. Enjoy. Clip two.
I'd like to know if any of the Democrats on this committee are employing Judge Mershon's daughter.
Please tell me what that has to do with Merrick Garland.
Is she a porn star?
Oh, Goldman. That's right. He's advising. Okay.
He's advising who? What? Do you know what we're here for? You know we're here about AG.
I don't think you know what you're here for.
Well, you the one talking about. I guess
I think your fake eyelashes are messing up.
No, ain't nothing.
Hold on.
Listen.
Order,
Mr. Chairman.
That's beneath even
order.
Against
the order of your committee.
Order.
I do have a point of order, and I would like to move to take down Ms. Green's words.
That is absolutely unacceptable. How dare you attack the physical appearance of another person?
Are your feelings hurt?
Her words down.
Aww.
Oh, girl, baby girl.
Oh, really?
Don't even play.
Baby girl,
We are going to move and we're going to take your words down.
I second that motion.
So who will have to pay us? Okay. Miss Green agrees to strike her words.
I believe she should apologize. No.
Perry, okay, hold on. Then after Mr. Perry's going to be recognized, then Miss Green.
I'm not apologizing.
Well, then
okay, reserve the right to object.
Perry, I am not Perry. Apologizing.
Now let's go. Come on, guys.
Baby girl, that's AOC getting her Bronx accent when she needs it. And she actually didn't. I think her family was from there, but she was mostly raised in I think it was Long Island or somewhere else in New York. It was not the inner city Bronx that she affects. I mean, Marjorie Taylor Greene to bring up eyelashes, it gets silly. And it gets even sillier and even more debased as we go on. But, you know, this is fun. I remember Congressman Robert K. Dornan, California, was a firebrand conservative in the 80s, 90s in the House. And there was a guy named Thomas Downey who's in New York. And I can't remember what they were arguing over. It may have been aid to the Contras or something like that. The Nicaraguan war between the Marxist Sandinistas and the U.S.-backed Contras. And they had a big spat on the House floor. And they said that, and Thomas, the congressman said that Robert Dornan grabbed him. And Robert Dornan said he was just straightening his tie. They almost had a fist fight. It's a long history of violence and fist fights. Insults. So I'm not going to really single this out, but it's just really silly. It gets worse. Let's watch this as they go back and forth, and then the committee hearing, the chairman gets involved. He has hearing aids, can't even hear what's going on. It's just doesn't give you a lot of confidence in Congress. Clip three.
You're not out of order.
You don't have enough intelligence.
Order. Chair recognizes Mr. Perry.
Okay, move to strike the.
I move to strike the lady's words again. That's two requests to strike.
Oh, they cannot take the words.
There's another motion to strike her words again. Here's the correct
apology. Ms. Green, do you ask unanimous do you agree to unanimous consent to strike your words?
I repeat again for the second time. Yes, I'll strike my words, but I'm not apologizing.
Without objection. Without objection.
Mr. Chair, point of order.
Who's?
It's me.
Ms. Crockett.
I'm just curious, just to better understand your ruling, if someone on this committee then starts talking about somebody's bleach blonde, bad built, butch body, that would not be engaging in personalities, correct?
A what now?
Chairman, I make a motion to strike those words.
I don't think that's
Hold
a
on.
Parliament.
I'm trying to find clarification on what quality.
Chairman, motion to strike
those
words.
I had no idea
words.
What you just said.
We're not gonna do this. Look, you guys earlier literally just
said you just voted to do
it.
You just voted to do it. Order.
I'm trying to get clarification.
Look, it. Calm down.
No, because this is what y'all do.
Proceeding.
So I'm trying to get clarification.
Ms. Crockett, you're not recognized. Ms. Crockett.
I can't hear you with your yelling.
That was Congresswoman Jasmine Crockett. I love it. Her referencing Marjorie Taylor Greene as beach blonde, butch body, whatever that was. Wow. They really got down and dirty, and they got down and dirty quick. It's just chaos. The chairman has no clue. He has hearing aids. He explained later. Can't really hear anything they're saying. I think he actually repeated what they said. The insults like over and over. It's just silliness. Maybe this is why Congress isn't getting stuff done. But frankly, historically, I would always say I'd rather Congress have days like this than days where they're passing bad legislation. I wish this had happened instead of passing the Patriot Act back in 2001 or two, whatever year that was passed. I had to look that up. I wish this had happened when they passed instead of passing the Inflation Reduction Act. So it all depends. I kind of like a dysfunctional, non-working, non-legislative Congress. We don't need any new laws, legislation. Certainly don't need any new laws. I mean, you need, I guess, things to keep the government running. But usually when they're in session, all they're really doing is expanding government's power over the individual. So I'd much rather watch this, the bad beach body, butch, whatever, the beach blonde, butch body insults and long eyelash insults than I would most of the legislation they contemplate and pass. So I'm not going to be one of those people who are like, this is outrageous. They should be said. And also, the only other thing that's so silly, having worked in the United States Senate, as a senior aide. The idea, strike this from the record. It's like the courtroom. You say something, it's like the jury will disregard that comment. You know, never heard it. You said it, you meant it. I did see Marjorie Taylor Greene was, I'll have it stricken from the record, but I won't have, I'm not apologizing. You know, I don't know. At this point, it's all semantics, silliness. Anyway, thought you would enjoy that. That was a lot of fun. And that's a viral video. Okay. The next thing before we get into, well, the next clip is on wind power, but I wanted to tell you the breaking news, the alternative breaking news. And that is of what's happening with the net zero agenda with home ownership. And this is actually quite scary because it's another tentacle. Remember the banality of evil, if you will. That is the, it's an old Nazi phrase, the story described Nazi Germany, where you had these mid-level bureaucrats doing horrible things and enforcing horrible atrocities. But in their minds, they were just doing their job, following orders. They were just a cog in the wheel and they had to do their job. And if they didn't, something bad would happen to them. Well, that's what's sort of happening in this whole right now. We're witnessing this in the net zero agenda where they're basically collapsing energy, food, transportation. You have corporate government collusion. The banks are all in. The big CEOs of all these companies are all, everyone's in on all this crap, whether it's the whole woke agenda, critical race and transgenderism, central bank, digital. It's just everyone's in because this is the thing. This is what everyone wants you to do. Well, here's the news, Bloomberg News. In Germany right now, more than 60% of homes need to undergo green renovations to meet the new EU, European Union's stricter energy requirements. The lenders, the banks working with the EU bureaucrats, are going to focus on homes' energy consumption. In other words, you won't be able to sell your house because no bank will give the buyer a loan to buy it because you're not meeting the new EU energy climate net zero regulations. Really deep and scary stuff. These new rules may leave a substantial dent in property values, unquote. Do you realize what's happening here? And the Biden administration is now proposing these same things here, the green building standards and other things. People will not be able to get a loan to buy your house. You may not even be able to list your house unless you do, in some cases, 30, 40, $50,000, $100,000 worth of renovations on your home. These could be everything from new windows, insulation, upgrading furnaces, water heaters, appliances. Who knows what the bureaucrats will come up with? It could change day to day, week to week, month to month. There's no standards. They just invoke this crap on the public. But do you understand this is a direct assault on private home ownership? There's going to be a lot more foreclosures, asset seizures. Hey, private equity firms, equity asset would love to come in and buy these homes that are non-compliant with our new strict energy requirements. They're saving the planet, don't you know? We have to do this. Everyone's all in on climate and net zero. We have to reduce our carbon footprint. You have to reduce your carbon footprint. So you can't sell your house. You got to do those upgrades. You don't have the money. Too bad. Too effing bad. Forfeit. The bank will buy your house. We'll put it up for auction. What's going on in Germany? A little more detail. Bank warns of growing energy-related risks. Lenders across Europe focus on energy building consumption. Capital relief for green loans offers securitization options. Across Europe's banks are trying to get a handle on how to figure a growing risk lurking in residential mortgage portfolios, energy consumption. In Germany, the largest economy, is increasingly clear that many households are either unwilling or unable to devote the funds necessary to upgrading the energy efficiency of their homes. The German Bundesbank has already warned the failure to act may leave substantial dent in property values with knock-on effects in the wider economy. Deutsche Bank Attorney General, meanwhile, says a tiny fraction of its residential customers are currently eligible for green loans. Think about that. In other words, even if your house is compliant, there's people not even eligible to get. Well, I guess they're saying that the customers, if you own a house, your house is not eligible for these green loans. This is pretty involved, deep, frightening crap that they're pulling right now. And this, and I'll have updates on this as we go forward, but the Biden administration is proposing similar things here in the United States. But this is happening now. People always say, oh, climate lockdowns would never happen. This is the form of that, where they're going after home ownership. Okay, this next one is about wind power. And it's a, this is David, the simple questions that David Frost asked the minister, Lord Callaghan, in the UK. I believe this is House of Lords. So let's watch this clip. They're talking about, if wind is so cheap, why do we have to subsidize it? This has been going on for decades. Wind and solar is so much cheaper, and oh, they can power everything, and fossil fuels just need to move out of the way. Really? Then why are we spending trillions subsidizing wind and solar? Why do we have to mandate it? If they're so effing great, why do we have to ban the competition? If EVs are so great, why do we have to ban gas-powered cars? If you were a sporting event, like, oh, the greatest team of all time, okay, let's have a big game and find out, oh, no, we're not going to play. We banned our opponents from actually playing because we're so great. But we're cheaper and greater. Here it is. This is... David Frost asking the minister, Lord Callaghan, UK House of Lords, I believe, about wind power.
Well, I thank the minister for that response, but I do gently suggest that perhaps he needs to look more carefully at the plausibility of the assessment he's just given us. If renewables are as cheap as he asserts, it's hard to understand why Bill and taxpayers are having to pay about £12 billion a year in subsidy, £600 for every family in the country, or why, if offshore wind can be produced for £50 megawatt hour, as his department asserts, the government has to offer twice that this year to get anyone to take up a contract. Would the minister agree that it's better to be honest, and that pushing out these fantasy figures just makes it easier for the proponents of net zero and the party opposite to indulge in fantasy politics, that the whole energy sector can be decarbonised in just 6 years' time?
Well, I certainly agree that the opposition's policy is fantasy politics, but it is also true to say, and I'll give the noble lord the cost, that the latest published analysis shows that electricity from offshore wind is 60% cheaper to build and operate than gas-fired power. The levelised costs are £44 per megawatt hour for offshore wind versus £114 per megawatt hour for closed-cycle gas turbines.
All those stats they're giving you are just complete horseshit from beginning to end. This is requiring the banning of the competition. It's requiring massive credits, subsidies, and mandates. And yeah, it might be cheaper to build than, say, a fossil fuel energy thing. But what kind of energy do these produce? They ever look at that equation? Solar and wind are about less than 5% of U.S. energy production. Of electricity, we're still in the low teens. And that's despite all of the bullshit that they've done with all of the subsidies and mandates and green stimuluses and everything, the carbon trading markets. And it's incredible. The corporate government collusion, the net zero goals, and they still can't make it work. And it's not going to work. We showed you the clip yesterday, Friday, of Larry Fink, a BlackRock CEO, basically saying, well, because of artificial intelligence, all the data centers, their power is going to be unbelievable what we need. And of course, you can't run that on solar and wind intermittent. That's just not going to happen. How do you say? He said the quiet part out loud. Even Larry Fink is admitting that. This is just nonsense. If it's so great, go ahead. Build it without the trillions of dollars in mandates and subsidies. Make it happen. Don't keep destroying our economy and mandating and shutting down and making everything more expensive because you have these important stats. According to this, it's cheaper. Look, our analysis right here. I can read you every little fact on here. It's cheaper. The paper says so. Get the paper and shove it up your... Okay, sorry. Sorry, I'm calming down. All right. Sorry about that. Final clip. Dr. Tedros of the WHO. Who is Dr. Tedros? I always try to avoid saying his last name. It's too complicated. But this is Simone Gold, the doctor, the frontline doctor, telling us who Dr. Tedros, the World Health Organization, is. And we're going to have more on this because we're coming up on the WHO pandemic treaty meeting in Geneva, Switzerland, and all the amendments. I'm hoping it's looking good at the moment, like there's not going to be any major agreement or anything's going to happen because of they're just falling apart. Hopefully the developing world torpedoes this again. But here's who's Dr. It's Dr. Simone Gold talking about who is Tedros, the leader of the World Health Organization.
But exactly who is Dr. Tedros? Before Dr. Tedros came to the WHO, he was the health officer for his home nation of Ethiopia. When he was the health officer in Ethiopia, Human Rights Watch reported that Tedros engaged in widespread political persecution, right? He withheld food and medicine from Ethiopians that were of ethnicities unlike his own. Specifically, I am told that the group that was hurt the worst are the Amharans, who are now, quote, missing 2 million people due to lack of food, lack of medicine. This was under his tenure as the health officer of Ethiopia. Prior to being the health officer of Ethiopia, he was actually the third highest member of Ethiopia's Tigray People's Liberation Front, which is a hard left organization that became part of the Ethiopian People's Revolutionary Democratic Front, a known terrorist organization. So Tedros is this hard, hard leftist with a history of killing or allowing to be killed many of his own citizens. So in him, the Chinese Communist Party saw a tremendous ally. So when he ran for the position of head chief of the World Health Organization, he was running against five other people. Interestingly enough, all of them were medical physicians. The only one who was not a medical physician is Dr. Tedros. And that's the guy that China put forward. And he's in the middle of his 10-year term.
10-year term. China put forward, not a medical doctor, very sketchy past. He is not the banality of evil, that mid-level bureaucrat who's just following orders. He is the high level doing the bidding of that, of China, the billionaires like Bill Gates, who's the number one single largest funder to the World Health Organization. He is the one, he is not the banality of evil. He's the obvious face of evil. How does that sound? Huh? Does it quite work? I need a B word, an alliteration with banality of evil and the alliteration. I wanted to read this to you because this is, I keep using this phrase, banality of evil, but here's the history of it. Eichmann in Jerusalem, A Report on the Banality of Evil. It's a 1963 book by the philosopher and political thinker Hannah Arendt. She's a Jew who fled Germany during Adolf Hitler's rise to power. She reported on the trial of Adolf Eichmann and the major organizer. And essentially, the subtitle famously introduced the phrase, the banality of evil. In part, the phrase refers to Eichmann's deportment at the trial, as the man displayed neither guilt nor actions for hatred of those trying him, claiming he bore no responsibility for Nazi atrocities because he was, quote, simply doing his job. He did his duty. He obeyed orders. He also obeyed the law, unquote. Okay. Think about that. Think about it during COVID when I met people, my son's basketball referee. You know, we just got to do this. This is part of my job. I'm going to have to throw you out if you don't. He tried to throw me out. He said, you're out of here. And I'm like, I'm not going anywhere. I dared him to call the police on me, which he did not do because I wouldn't wear a mask, we're talking about. But anyway, that's how they get the banality of evil. They make it so your job and your ability to feed your family, own a home, hold down a job is tied to this agenda. You're an important cog in the wheel. You have to do your agenda. And this is why policemen were arresting people in restaurants and grabbing even kids if they went in without a vaccine card or not wearing masks, whatever. This is insane. And this is the banality of evil, where everyday workers and government workers, corporate government collusion, become tools of this tyrannical state. We saw it in COVID. And we're seeing it now, you know, from everything from the Patriot Act to the emergency decrees. We're seeing it throughout the censorship regime. Like, I've got to do my job. You have to censor you. We're seeing it with the January 6th, with the pro-lifers being arrested. We saw it with the election. It's people following the orders, and no one stops to question why or whether it's necessary. We're seeing it in Europe with the shutdown of energy, food, transportation, and all over the world with this net zero agenda. But it's our goal. We have to meet our goals. The German transport minister floating the idea of weekend car bans in order to meet his transportation sector's net zero goals. I'm sorry if your family can't drive on the weekend. We have to meet our goals. We have to meet our goals. France banning short-haul flights of 2.5 hours less. I'm sorry if you can't fly anymore. We have to, transportation sector has to meet our climate goals. This is where it comes from, the people following orders. They themselves will face repercussions. This is how the state gets you. It's frightening stuff. All right. We have to take a break. And we are going to come back with Cameron Hamilton, former Navy SEAL, Republican congressional district, Republican candidate for the 7th congressional district in the state of Virginia, husband, father of 3, Navy SEAL combat veteran. And we're going to talk all about why he's running, foreign policy, and what's wrong with our Congress today. We'll be back on Unleashed with Mark Morano on TNT with Cameron Hamilton. Stay tuned.
TNT's James Freeman.
You could even come on to tell me that the BBC is a bastion of truth and greatness, and that the vaccines have saved millions of lives, like my guest John yesterday did. But don't expect me to play nice like I did with John yesterday, bless him. I have posted that interview with John on X this morning and asked people to post evidence for him to review. Because let's be frank, that interview was a bit of a shocker, wasn't it? And this is the problem that we are up against. Millions of misinformed people who still think that the vaccines saved millions of lives, despite the evidence not being evidence at all, just modeled data that has been produced to show what the pharma companies want people to believe.
James Freeman on today's News Talk, TNT.
The Light is Britain's far-right conspiracy theory paper spreading hate and vicious lies. No, that's what the BBC say. The Light is the only national newspaper bringing you the real news and informed opinion on what's really going on today. You can subscribe, order copies, submit articles, and read back issues on our website, thelightpaper.co.uk, and see for yourself why the establishment are so worried about the uncensored truth getting out to people every month. The Light Paper. Not far right, just right so far. thelightpaper.co.uk.
Now I want to say this, and I'm going to say it just once.
This is today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to Unleashed with Mark Morano on TNT. All right, joining the program now is Cameron Hamilton, former Navy SEAL, who's now a Republican congressional candidate for the 7th District. He was also former division director at Homeland Security. Welcome to the program, Cameron.
Hey, thank you for having me.
All right, first of all, thank you for your service as a Navy SEAL. You served. Can you tell us a little bit about your military service and then also about your time as the former division director at Homeland Security?
Absolutely. So I served as a SEAL for 10 years. I initially enlisted to become a hospital corpsman. I wanted to embody the characteristics of both being a warrior and a healer. I had a unique opportunity to do that in the SEAL teams. I did 4 deployments, 2 combat deployments to Afghanistan, 2 deployments in support of Operation Enduring Freedom, and it was a privilege and an absolute honor. After that time, I worked at the State Department for 5 years within a program called Project Guardian, protecting U.S. dignitaries, the Secretary of State, and many others overseas. And then I transitioned in 2020 to work for the Department of Homeland Security, originally under the Trump administration, to serve as the Emergency Medical Services Division Director, overseeing standards of about 4,000 EMTs on the southern border. What we saw on the southern border is just an absolute nightmare. And right now it's porous, it's open, and it's really just a flagrant violation of U.S. law, and I won't abide by it. So I hung up my hat as a civil servant, and now I'm running for U.S. Congress.
Wow. Well, thank you very much. That's incredible. All right. So what led you to run? You said you wouldn't abide, you know, by what's happening, but have you been thinking of this for a while? What prompted you to run, and who is your opponent, and what's your main issues here running in the state of Virginia for Congress?
So I'm running for the Republican primary here in the Virginia 7th. It's an open seat. Abigail Spanberger is the current representative. She's not seeking re-election. She's actually running for governor in 2025. So it presents a whole new calculus on the winnability of this seat. I was approached by a gentleman named Nick Freitas and other great patriots in the Virginia area. He's currently my state delegate in the House. And he asked me whether I would consider running because of my unique federal experience. It was not something I originally thought I would get into, but it is nonetheless something that I believe God has put on my heart, my family's heart, to serve others. So right now I'm running as a constitutional conservative for the Republican primary. The primary is on June 18th, and of course, we'd support anyone, we'd appreciate anyone's support for the Republican primary. That will determine the nominations for both the Republican Party and the Democratic Party for the general election in November. Most likely, the Democratic nominee will be a gentleman named Eugene Vindman. He is the twin brother of Alexander Vindman, who testified again during Trump's impeachment call during Trump's impeachment hearing for the Ukrainian phone call. So I'm running up against a political hack here in the system, and we're running strong. We plan to beat him in November.
All right. So let's go through the issues that you're finding that are driving you to run and what you'd like to do in Congress. Let's start with what you mentioned, the border. As a congressman and as a, you know, as a budding political leader here, what would you like to see happen at the U.S. southern border? What needs to happen immediately?
First and foremost, I think we need to strip all funding away from immigration relocation services to the United States interior. We've created a financial incentive for migrants to come here, to be willing to experience some of the most awful treatment known to man, to be trafficked, and then to personally benefit and or receive financial assistance from the United States to then be moved to the U.S. interior. We spend billions of dollars moving migrants throughout the southern border to the U.S. interior, and that's one of the first programs that I would hope to cut completely. If we are relocating individuals based upon asylum claims, I think they should be required to pay that back. We require American citizens who are being evacuated from overseas locations to the U.S. abroad to pay those costs back. Why are we not asking migrants to do the same thing? We're not even American citizens. So that's some of many different things. I also want to rescind some of the authorities that's been given to the Attorney General under 8 U.S. Code 1158, 8 U.S. Code 1254, the temporary protected status designation. I think we've given way too much authority to the executive to flagrantly apply their version of what a temporary protected status individual is or what an asylum process looks like. I think those are key things that Congress can uniquely do to ensure that we're securing the southern border. In addition to that, a good friend of mine, Chairman Mark Green from the Homeland Committee, Congressman from Tennessee, he's endorsed my campaign. He impeached Mayorkas, even against the wishes of many in the Republican Party. I think that's another example of things that Congress should be doing to ensure our southern border is secure.
Yeah, well, what's your opinion on Mayorkas? I mean, is he all-knowing and the architect of this, or is he following orders? Is he a victim in this? I mean, is this one of his lifelong passions, was this preside over an open border?
He's definitely not all-knowing, and I think he is in a position where he has to obey the orders of the president. Having said that, he's certainly ideologically in line with the president on this issue. So there's a heavy degree of culpability in the actions that we're seeing right now, which is part of what frustrated me so much being a civil servant, managing others, seeing the chaos. After the election of 2020, we saw what was happening with the southern border. We saw the intelligence reports and analysis even in December and then early January. We knew the border was going to fall apart. President Biden, on day one of being sworn into office, what does he do? He rescinds the Remain in Mexico policy and completely changes the enforcement parameters that Trump had previously set, which were working and effective. So Mayorkas happily adopted those prerogatives. So Mayorkas is exceedingly culpable, which is why as soon as I resigned from DHS due to the Hatch Act requirement and I announced my candidacy, I immediately called for either his public resignation or impeachment because of breach of public trust.
Wow. And now here's the big question. All these illegals that have entered during the last several years, what do we do with them? Once you're in the U.S., do you stay? Have we ever had in recent decades anyway, any kind of mass deportation program? It just seems like no matter what happens, we will never send anyone back. Is that the way you see this now? Is there an actual way to deport people, illegals?
We have never seen anything like this. We have millions and millions of people. By the end of this administration's term, which Lord willing, that will be in November when we get Donald Trump back in office, after the election in November, then ultimately January of 2025, we will, by some estimates, between 5 and 10 million people will have come here. It's just an absurd number. That's larger than the country of Norway, for example. And so what I think the first thing we have to do is to secure the border, to stop the flow in. That has to come first and foremost. Otherwise, you're trying to drain the boat when it's got a hole in it. It's a futile effort. Yeah. Number two, then we have to look at rapidly prosecuting and finding those that commit crimes, violent felons, and then working our way down the echelons of priorities. It won't be clean. It won't be easy. It will be very difficult, very challenging. And so the only category of individuals that will be even more challenging to deal with are those that were brought here as minors. Were they technically grown adults, but now they are grown adults, like what we had with the Dreamer scenario? That will be very difficult, and the courts will have to weigh in on exactly how that enforcement looks. But we have to find a way to prioritize securing the border and then removing individuals who cause harm and who actually are also considered wards of the state. The public charge rule, I think, is absolutely critical. We have to reinforce that to ensure that people that come here are not doing so at a cost to Americans.
Yeah, and your point about not funding is, I know a lot of organizations have buses, everything waiting for them. And that's because they're getting federal grants, right? So that creates that incentive to encourage these people to come across, because then they're taken away to interior cities.
Here's the dirty secret that your viewers may not want to hear, but it's absolutely true. We have faith-based organizations that are making hundreds of millions of dollars a year on relocating migrants to the United States interior. It's just reality. You have Catholic Charities of America, you have Lutheran Immigration Relocation Services. They're making substantial amounts of money, again, paid for by the American taxpayer. That's a huge problem. So we've created a direct financial incentive to not only assist, but to facilitate and encourage this mass migration effort. Because why? There's profitability in it. It's really awful. This is not to throw everyone of these particular faith demographics in these categories. It is to say that there's many entities and nonprofits that are profiting immensely. We have to stop this.
All right, this is an odd question, but it actually captured the immigration debate for me in a way that nothing had prior to this. When Ron DeSantis, coordinating with the governor of Texas, brought the Argentinians to Martha's Vineyard. It was obviously a cheap publicity stunt. You could argue that they used the poor migrants to make a political point. But I thought a huge segment of America got to expose the hypocrisy of these sanctuary cities and all this rhetoric that's been going on for years. They literally, you may have the details, but I don't remember. They landed in Martha's Vineyard. They were given bulk food. They didn't have caviar and champagne and the nice food that you'd expect in Martha's Vineyard. They were given bulk food, boxed cereal, canned goods, and they were literally shipped out either the next day or a day and a half later as fast as they could get them. But they wandered around the town. The town was like, oh, we welcome you with open arms. And then here's the National Guard. Get the hell out of here. Did you think that was a good stunt? Did that backfire? Do you think it was important to show the hypocrisy? What was your opinion of that whole stunt with Ron DeSantis and Texas governor?
I think the more we can do to ensure that everyday Americans can appreciate the gravity of what's going on at the southern border, the better. I think people don't realize the cost. I don't think they realize the human cost and the humanitarian catastrophe we've created. So events like what we saw at Martha's Vineyard, as well as many others, they might look like a political showboat, but again, I think this is what happens when your failed policies come home to roost in your own backyard. I'm a firm supporter of showing the American people the dirty, real reality of these kinds of decisions. So I think at the end of the day, it probably was a tactful move. I think, again, we have to pull the Band-Aid off and understand that we're not going to fix this problem if we don't fully understand the gravity of it.
All right. And I guess one more question. The idea of you were talking about deporting anyone, obviously criminal elements and anyone else causing problems. But in terms of mass deportation, it almost seems like, I mean, I almost think that we need to be realistic. I know when Donald Trump ran for president, it was in 2016, early on, he was, there's a certain conservative base that goes crazy if you say you're not going to deport people, is what I'm trying to say, or anti-illegal immigration base, which I'm part of. But I just think you have to be realistic. There's no way you could ever do mass deportations of these migrants, given the fact that I don't know the percentage off the top of my head, but I had someone else on from DHS, the former director, last week or the week before, saying, that essentially they don't even come from, they're not going to come from Mexico. What are you going to do? Drop them over the Texas border and let them run? At least Mexico's not going to want them. And they're from all different countries around the world at this point. What do you practically do with the ones who are nonviolent, who aren't criminals? I mean, is there any way, or are we basically at the point where we have to say, who's ever come over, the vast majority, in fact, 90% plus, are going to be staying here? There's no way we can deport them. There's nowhere to send them unless you're going to have an unprecedented thing that we've never seen in U.S. history. I just try to be, do you want to react to that? That's my own opinion. I haven't even developed it that far. I just don't know how we would ever deport these people.
That's a valid concern. I think right now, again, we would have to go through a list of priorities, first and foremost, to find the people that we have to remove, you know, on the top tier, and then move our way down, because that we would have to triage this effort, because we've never seen numbers like this. Once we work our way down, yeah, they're right. There's a lot of folks that we're going to have to figure out, what do we do with these people? Many of them have come here. Many of them just want to live in peace. I don't blame them for that. Our nation is very pro-immigration. I just want it to be done legally. So likely what we would have to do, if anyone goes to these actual holding facilities or detention centers down on the southern border, it would not look anything like what you expect. It would not look like you have Mexicans or even Central and South Americans. You have a huge preponderance of Africans. You have a huge preponderance of those from the Middle East and from parts of Northeast Asia, Southeast Asia, you name it, all over the world. You have Eastern Europeans that are there. We have ethnic Chechens and many others. I mean, it is the broadest and most amalgamous broad group that you could imagine at these detention centers. So it's not just those from Mexico. Likely what we would have to do is some form of a nationalized registry. What I don't support is individuals being moved up ahead in the line to become citizens. If they want to pursue a pathway to citizenship, they'll have to engage in a registration process, apply for a worker's visa. If we can document them and categorize them, then they can fall in line and wait the process just like anyone else to obtain citizenship. What is so convoluted in this argument is that there are many on the political left that want to see citizenship granted en masse, which I think is a categorical mistake, an absolute failure of policy. So I think what we would have to do practically is engage in a nationwide registry where you apply, we document you, we determine your status, we see, are you able to make ends meet? As long as you're not a public charge, there may have to be a period where we figure out just what exactly to do with all these personnel. We may be encouraging also some of these other nations to take them back. Colombia has ironically stepped up, and they've actually committed quite a bit of their national funds to relocate migrants from Colombia back to their national interior. I think we would have to pursue programs like that. But the last thing is, if we talk about all these nations that are falling apart and we're dealing with migrants because of political persecution or civil unrest, why are we not levying economic sanctions against those nations because of the impugned and brought about financial hardship and burden put on Americans? It's not our responsibility to ensure that we're providing resources to other nations which are falling apart. So that's, I think, another leverage that would have to be used with, here's economic sanctions. If you don't agree to sanctions, then partner with us and bring some of these migrants back to your jurisdictions. So it won't be easy. It'll require probably a lot of negotiation, but I think a nationwide registry will be the first way to start it.
All right. Well, so that's going to be, you know, one of the greatest challenges we're facing here. And that's why this 2024 election is so critical, both in the level you're running Congress and, of course, for the presidency. In terms of foreign policy, what is your view of foreign policy? We have, you know, Ukrainian aid right now. We have the Israeli conflict with Hamas in the Middle East. And what's your general view of U.S. foreign policy? We pulled out of Afghanistan. That was a disaster a few years back. How do you see U.S. foreign policy position?
Yeah, the Afghan withdrawal was an absolute disaster. And again, I've lost friends over there. Many people have. I've bled in that soil myself. It's just absolutely terrible. And not only that, but then we lost more American patriots at the airport with what was an absolute botched withdrawal. Nobody in the DOD was really held properly accountable. So it's an embarrassment nationally. I will say, when it comes to foreign aid and investment, I'm a strong supporter of Israel. I always have been, but I hate the fact that we bundle these foreign aid bills in a way that are inconsistent. And again, it ties a conflict in Israel or other nations like Ukraine. These have nothing to do with one another. They should be funded separately. And I think also it's a good way to show that the Democratic Party really doesn't stand with our nation's partner, Israel. In addition to that, at the end of the day, the American people need to recognize we are $200 billion a month in a budget deficit. Every single year, we add $1.5 to $2 trillion in additional debt. This year, we will be paying more on our nation's debt on the interest alone than the entire national defense budget. That is not sustainable. So why we keep promoting and elevating and prioritizing sending more money overseas versus securing our southern border versus ensuring that the United States is not insolvent in its existing obligations, we only expand more programs and authorities and pay for more things. This is fiscal insanity. Any Fortune 500 company that ran itself this way would go bankrupt in a matter of weeks. It's time that we return back to fiscal constraint and ensure that if nations want our assistance and aid, they have to justify it to us, not the other way around. And it sure as heck seems like we have legislators in D.C. that are promoting sending money overseas that, number one, we don't have. Number two, we print securities and then pay the interest on those securities to borrow money to send overseas. This is nonsense.
All right. And what's your what is your position, if you will, on the whole green agenda? You have the Inflation Reduction Act, which was passed, now going into the trillions of dollars, solar, wind subsidies, seems to be the rationing of energy. John Kerry said they're coming after American agriculture. You have restrictions on fertilizer, restrictions on methane, animal agriculture. And you also have the gas-powered car ban happening with EV mandates. The government's going to tell us there's only one government car you can buy, an EV. What's your position on that whole agenda?
I want to repeal it. I think the Inflation Reduction Act was an absolute, again, there's nothing about reducing inflation in that act whatsoever. It did quite the opposite. So again, we're borrowing more money. We're devaluing our own currency to do things like this. That is actually perpetuating and expanding inflation. People forget now, hey, inflation's on the decline. No, it's not. It's actually not on the decline. The rate at which it was accelerating is slowing down, but our inflation is still rising. So we still have onsetting inflation every year. And so I radically oppose it because, again, I'm all for renewable sources of energy. What I don't want it to happen is where it's funded on the backs of American taxpayers who are barely making payroll and who are not sure what they're going to do next month based upon whether or not their paycheck is the same size as what this month was. Americans are struggling. We also have people in Flint, Michigan that still don't have clean water. I mean, give me a break. At some point, we got to put this politics aside and actually worry about caring for people here in the United States. And I don't see it.
What about free speech issues? The Biden administration making several attempts now with disinformation czars, disinformation boards, censoring speech. It seems like in the once free West now, if you disagree with anything the official government narrative, you're automatically a disinformer who's subject to canceling, defunding, and censorship. What can you as a congressman or what can Congress do to defend free speech in America?
I think we need to ensure that we keep the parameters of our First Amendment very clear so that the government does not infringe on people's abilities to say, communicate, even if we don't like it. I have serious concerns about some of the free speech legislation that's come forward in Congress right now. I've been radically opposed to FISA because, look, every conservative under the sun, right? What do? We panel and we talk about the Second Amendment. I'm a Second Amendment absolutist. Why are we Fourth Amendment absolutists? Why aren't we absolutists on some of the other constitutional guarantees and limitations to power? So I agree with your sentiments earlier. We have a huge free speech problem in this country that we need to radically ensure that we restrain government intrusion. The FISA courts rebuked the Department of Justice for nearly 300,000 individual violations of Americans' protected privacy rights. That is a grotesque injustice. And what's worse is almost nobody was held accountable. And now Congress has reauthorized FISA again. There were 56 amendments offered. Not a single one of them limited the intrusion the government has. In fact, many of them are offering amendments to expand the authority to include any public Wi-Fi. We are continually moving forward towards a surveillance state. And this is something that our founders warned us about, and we should heed their warning.
Would you repeal the Patriot Act? And that's a final question. And then give us your websites.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Very good. Like to hear that. Where can people find information about your campaign?
Well, I'd be honored. Again, I live in Orange, Virginia, the resting place of James Madison. Please go to CameronHamilton.com. It's about we the people. It's not about political parties and it's not about politics. We the people. CameronHamilton.com.
You got my vote if I live there, especially for repealing the Patriot Act. All right. Thank you. Cameron Hamilton, GOP candidate for Congress, former Navy SEAL. Thank you for your service and good luck with your run. We appreciate you taking the time today.
Thank you, and God bless.
Thank you. This is Unleashed with Mark Morano on TNT. Today's News Talk. We'll see you next time. Thanks for watching.